Our guest, Ethan Zuckerman, is up there for me with Yo-Yo Ma among my shining ideals of the global citizen. He's a geek with an inspiring worldview, a view of who we are as human beings and world citizens, and of how we know and connect with each other, and how all of that is evolving in the digital age. Ethan is the father of this exemplary network of blogs called Global Voices Online, a brilliant model, I think, of how this global species will get to know itself and its extensions anew through the web. So it's a further pleasure and privilege to be welcoming Solana Larson, herself a pioneer in global media. She's the new editor of Global Voices Online, or GVO, as we call it. This conversation this evening is going to start with the thinking behind the GVO brainchild, and I hope it won't end until we have made some very tangible working connections between GVO and open source heading into the future. And not to be coy about it, I've always wanted to air more of the actual voices of Global Voices on open source. We've done it some in the past. We're looking to do it regularly in the future. Ethan, get us started. Give us the history, your history, on the way to Global Voices Online.
Well, thanks for having us, Chris. And
one of the really strange things about this organization is that despite the fact that we've now worked together for 9 months, something like that, this is the second time we're ever meeting face-to-face. And just to point out quite how strange that is, I ran into Rod Beckstrom, who wrote a very clever book called The Starfish and the Spider. And Beckstrom's a sort of fascinating polymath, and you ask him what the book's about, and if you get him to admit it, he'll tell you that he's interested in organizations that are tough to model because they have no clear leaders. And he said, you know, basically what I was trying to do was build a global peace movement, and I realized the right way to do it was to build it based on Al-Qaeda. And so I started talking to him and realized that we hadn't quite built a terrorist organization structure, but we long have used this word conspiracy to sort of describe what we do, because frankly it's very, very difficult to explain what all of our jobs are. And you start looking at our organizational structure, and you know, our managing director is somewhere off in Trinidad, and we're a Netherlands company, when I float around the world, and you know, Solana bounces back and forth between Denmark and Puerto Rico and New York. And so we're here to introduce and share the conspiracy with you guys. And I think to sort of do that, I should explain a little bit about where this comes from, and maybe we can think of this as where Global Voices was and where it's going, because we're sort of in the process of, you know, like any good founder, sort of letting the bird fly and handing it over to my co-conspirators who are now pushing it in different directions. You know, everyone in this room, probably with the exception of you, Chris, you know, is deeply used to a world where any of the stuff that we encounter can come from any sort of arbitrary location at any time. Our ability to ship bits from one place to atoms from one place to another is just unprecedented. It's kind of extraordinary if you think about our capability to do it. You stumble across it all the time. I was on a sort of an extended rant about Fiji water for a while. At Harvard, if you go into our student center and you buy bottled water, instead of Poland Spring, which you know sort of comes from up the road, you're getting water branded as Fiji, and I started looking into it and discovered that it actually is water from Fiji. The story behind it is pretty remarkable. There was a Canadian entrepreneur who wanted to build a resort in Fiji, discovered that he didn't have fresh water because it's a coral freaking atoll, and you actually don't have much water on coral atolls. He had to drill down, and in creating the aquifer for his resort, realized that he had a nice source of water, started bottling water, and then had the brilliant idea that you could start shipping water around the world. And the truth is, if you actually do the math on what it costs to put water in a shipping container and ship it to the United States, it's something along the lines of 5 to 10 cents a liter. It's actually very affordable to do. Now, nasty environmental implications, all sorts of strangeness as far as what this does to global economies. But just in terms of pure fiscal practicality, there's no reason that in my town of 8,000 people, I can't have a fish market that's got, you know, fish literally from everywhere, from Chile to Vietnam and the Philippines and so on and so forth. And most of the time, this is really great and really, really fun. Other times, it sort of freaks us out when you start looking at the factories in China where people are packing chicken, which might well be what you had for lunch or for dinner. And the notion of your chicken sort of being raised in the U.S., shipped to China to be processed, and then shipped back starts getting a little surreal, and it starts freaking out people who, you know, go to good Tony universities like this one when you start thinking about the high-end job that managed to allow me to build my career, now essentially being outsourced to various developing nations, tends to make people a lot more nervous. As we get really good at globalizing goods and services, we're actually less good at globalizing labor than we have been at other points in history. We think of this as sort of a peak time for globalization. It actually isn't in people terms. If you look at the period before World War I, you had a much higher proportion of people born in other countries than you currently have really in almost any country in the world. The world looked a whole lot more like Dubai or Qatar or any of these Gulf states that have enormous immigrant populations. Worldwide, it's something along the lines of 3 or 4% of people who are living other than in their country of origin. And at that peak time, you had sort of 13 or 14%, which is close to where we are in the U.S., and we're kind of freaking out about it. But where I really freak out about this stuff is globalization of bits, because there's this sort of amazing gap between the potential and the actual. If you actually want to find information from almost anywhere in the world, you can subscribe to this wonderful service, which will give you all the Nollywood films that are coming out. So Lagos has the third largest film industry in the world. For $10 a month, you can subscribe to as many Nollywood films as you can eat. I find for me that's about one a month is really all I can take. But, you know, if you're a homesick Nigerian, I mean, this is an incredibly useful thing to do. And rather than having to have your relatives go out to the market and buy you a pile of DVDs, you've got it online. You know, until recently, you could read the Iranian vice president's weblog, which he founded as a way of trying to communicate with the youth of Iran. I mean, you can even read the news coming out of North Korea. It's all the same story again and again and again. But you can read it. It's there on the web. It's sort of exciting. But then the question sort of becomes, what can you and can't you actually get information from? And this map, which I'm showing at the moment, I'm sure it looks great over the radio, is a NASA composite image of the world at night. And almost everybody I know who works in international development has this image as the background on their computer. It's such a powerful reminder because basically, when you look at this image, large chunks of the map are extremely dark. And they're dark for one of two reasons. You look at Eastern Russia, and it's dark because there just isn't anybody there. And then there's other places like Africa where you have 750 million people, and the only places that's light are on the southern tip and sort of right around the fringes. And basically, if you don't have electricity, you don't really have the ability to transmit bits to anybody. And this is sort of a very simple, straightforward way of thinking about what you do and don't get to see in a new digital universe. If you're not a glowing point of light on this map, it's very, very hard for the rest of the world to hear from you. And frankly, for you to be heard from, pretty awful things have to be happening to you for the world to pay attention at that point. There's a couple of other maps that are interesting. This is a really simplified map of undersea cables from a terrific little firm called Telegeography. And you look at this map, and there's this sort of, you know, giant, thick veins of connectivity between the U.S. and Europe, just as many bits as you could possibly want. There's quite a few connections across the Pacific Ocean. You see Japan is really well wired in, China's well wired in. You see fairly thick wires connecting India, connecting Australia, even connecting most of Latin America. And then you'll notice this single skinny wire sort of skating down the west coast of Africa. That's the SAT-3 cable. That's South Africa Telecom's cable. It's the only cable that connects Africa at the moment. There's an East African cable planned, but it hasn't been built yet. And basically, you know, the connection, the sort of high-speed data connection of Africa to the rest of the world is literally a sheaf of cable about the size of my arm. And if it gets cut, we don't have Africa anymore, in a very simple, literal sense of being sort of represented in this digital space. Other ways to think about who's represented and who's not. My colleagues at the Berkman Center at Harvard do a lot of work on a project called the Open Net Initiative. And this is a project that tracks filtering and censorship of the net. And if you sort of backtrack to 5 years ago, the only countries censoring the net in a serious way were China, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. My colleagues now track at least 24 nations that censor the net on an everyday basis.
And we see this every so often. People who were using YouTube a couple of weekends ago discovered that it wasn't working for a couple of hours there because Pakistan, in a particularly ham-handed attempt to shut off the net, managed to shut off access to YouTube to everybody for a couple of hours. But one of the things that really worries us is that some of the countries nowadays aren't just cutting access to critical political sites, just sites where people are critiquing the government, but are actually cutting off the tools of free speech, the tools that you use to blog, the tools that you use to share videos. And that gets very, very scary.
Can I interrupt you with a question about editorial judgment in our that forms our news? What did these patterns have to do with the decisions at the television networks, the New York Times, and elsewhere about what's news in the world? What's interesting? Who counts?
Well, here's a sort of a perfect setup for this. A lot of the work that I've been doing in the last 5 years has to do with making maps of media attention around the world.
Hmm.
And so I'll look at something that proxies the media. So, for instance, something like Google News, which when you search against Google News, you're really searching against the last 2 or 3 weeks' worth of global news. And if you go into Google News and say, hey, how many stories do you have on Ghana? And then you hold it up and say, okay, how many stories do you have on China? You get a very ugly, very rough, but actually very useful sort of comparison of the two. And if you do this over a long period of time, you get certain patterns. You discover that some nations are sort of red hot as far as media attention goes. You'll always see the US, Canada, India and China because they're huge, Australia because it's well-wired. For the entire duration of the time that I've been doing this work, Iraq has been bright red. I've never seen Israel anything other than bright red. I just sort of assume that as a rule, Israel is always in the news. And you'll see occasional pockets of the developing world that people pay some attention to. Egypt, Kenya, South Africa, Brazil to a certain extent. But you also find spots that are just deeply, deeply cool and never seem to warm up. You almost never see any news coming out of Central Africa. You almost never see any news coming out of Central Asia. And Eastern Europe is surprisingly weak as far as news coverage. And these things sort of iterate over time. Even at moments when you would think that these places end up being incredibly important. If you go back through history and sort of look at 9/11, suddenly people get very, very interested in Central Asia immediately after 9/11. But our interest in it dropped off very, very quickly. So there's some really interesting structural factors here. One of the reasons Israel's already always in the news is that almost every big news agency worth their salt has an Israel bureau. And at a certain point, if you have someone on the ground, they're going to continue filing stories. If you look to see, as newspapers have compressed where they're paying attention, everyone's maintained an Iraq bureau. We know that that's going to remain interesting over some period of time. But it's very, very hard to find people who are still maintaining a Nairobi bureau nowadays. And you're certainly not going to find anyone maintaining a Bangui bureau. If you don't have anyone on the ground in Bangui, you don't have any Central African Republic news. Mm. It's very, very hard to get that sort of attention.
You're talking old media. How does it change, Ethan, in your view? How should it change in digital media, in the blogosphere? I associate you, and I'm probably not doing it justice, but with the notion that, you know, if there were 100 bloggers in the Congo, our minds would be different on the subject of Central Africa, on a huge human emergency that's greatly undercovered. Where are we going in the world of, diversifying sure. the reporting on this whole species?
Well, so this is the hope, Chris, is that the internet lowers the cost of entry to this field quite a bit. Not only does it lower the cost of entry as far as giving you a printing press where you didn't have one previously, in a lot of cases where you have highly repressive nations, the internet ends up being one of the very few free ways that someone can get online and sort of express themselves. At the same time, though, you end up with a different problem. When I'm sort of mapping media attention, in many cases I'm mapping supply, what sort of news is out there. But the internet has changed the entire supply equation. Mm. There are now, 1,000 Kenyan bloggers. If you really wanted to be following the Kenyan post-election crisis clearly, there's a lot of places that you could look. At a certain point in a country where we have market-driven media, you have to ask some questions about demand. And I actually think if you look at how we sort of pay attention to each other in the internet space, you can find out a lot about our demand. I'm pretty obsessed these days with Nigeria. If you want to understand Africa, you have to understand Nigeria. There's no sort of two ways about it. It's the most populous country on the continent. It's one of the most strife-torn. It's, at this point, the U.S.'s fourth largest source of oil. You would think you'd hear about it all the time. It's so important to us. Actually, Nigeria's got the same population as Japan, but shows up in U.S. news roughly an eighth, roughly a ninth as often.
We know Fela Kuti better than any musician in Japan.
Well, but better than Fela Kuti, you probably know Mr. Moses Odiaka, who works for the Nigerian Petroleum Commission, who's been emailing you every couple of days, because this is sort of what the internet thinks of Nigeria nowadays. We tend to encounter Nigeria through 419 scams. In fact,
Is this the guy who keeps asking me to hold $10 billion for the weekend?
So what this guy is doing is giving you an updated version of one of the greatest old scams in history, what's called the Spanish prisoner scam. And the Spanish prisoner scam dates back to the 1500s, the 1600s, and the idea is someone says to you, I'm being held prisoner by the Spanish king. If you would only send money to secure my release, I have land and a beautiful daughter, and I would be happy to marry my beautiful daughter off to you, and you'll be a rich noble in the future. And essentially, the 419 scam, all of these petroleum scams, are a variant on that scam, but they've got a really interesting twist to it. In the Spanish prisoner scam, you're trying to get someone out of jail who's in there unfairly. In these 419 scams, you're actually trying to break the law. You're actually trying to steal money from the Nigerian government. So this leads to this really interesting disconnect about how Americans and Nigerians feel about this. And so this is a music video from an amazing Nigerian comedian named Osofia. And this guy is singing a song called I Go Chop Your Dollar. And in the song, there's this wonderful music video which shows this poor Lebanese businessman flying into Lagos Airport, being met by guys who are wearing very convincing-looking business suits and traditional dress. And the chorus to it is, Oyoba man, foreign man, I go chop your dollar. I'm going to steal your money. I'm going to take your money and disappear. 419 is just a game. You're the loser, I am the winner. So from the Nigerian side of this, there's a good bit of a sense of humor over all of this. The only way you'd ever fall for one of these internet scams is if you are A, stupid, and B, greedy. Now, obviously, this isn't how most Westerners feel about this. Most Westerners feel like they're being horribly abused by the Nigerians, and therefore it's fair to abuse them back. And now there's this whole movement of something called scam baiting, where you get one of these emails, and the game to it is to try to figure out how you can embarrass the guy who sent it to you as much as possible. So there's a whole game of getting people to take humiliating photos of themselves. You know, we have a young man here wearing a tutu with Sugar Plum Fairy written on his chest. Some really amazing artifacts. A guy who is notorious for trying to get items from his scammers and managed to get a wooden carved version of a Commodore 64 computer, a very beautiful one. Possibly the single best piece of scam baiting I've ever seen is this video.
We are closing for,
which is known as the scammer version of the dead parrot sketch. And the way this came about was there was a scam baiter who got an email, 419 scam, responded and said, look, I can't help you with your petroleum investment, but I should tell you, I'm a major film producer in the United States. If you audition for me, I may be able to get you a scholarship to come to the United States and study film. I need you to perform the dead parrot sketch from Monty Python. And these two enterprising young Nigerians went out, rented a store, and filmed the full 9-minute version of the dead parrot sketch, which I have to say, in many ways, I find more charming in sort of heavily Nigerian accented English than I find the original John Cleese version of all of this. But my point in all of this is, you know, my hope, Chris, was we'd introduce the internet, suddenly we're all connected to one another, we all hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and it just hasn't worked out that way. And what's happened instead is that we know so little about one another, and what we know about one another is so wrong in many cases, that our first instinct is to try to figure out how to shut each other off. And you see a lot of this nowadays of people on the net saying, how do I block all Nigerians from coming to my website? This is sort of a remarkable moment in time. The net, which was so open that in 1984, people literally believed the Soviet Union had joined this U.S. research network. Because there was no technical reason why it couldn't have happened. Mm. We're now getting to the point where we're trying to shut off entire nations from it. So my take on all of this is we have to work a whole lot harder. We can't just assume that being connected to one another solves these problems. If you let us work it out on our own, we tend to reinforce our own prejudices and stereotypes. You look at a site like Dig, you look at a site like Reddit. These are sites that promise the future of journalism. They say that the future of journalism is that everyone's going to get together and we're going to decide what's important. And then you got to ask your question, you know, who's we? Or, you know, maybe to use the famous quote from The Lone Ranger, you know, who's we, white man? Or more to the point, who's we, white geek, right? I mean, if you're getting your news from most of these sites, you're getting a very particular, tech-heavy, particular view of politics, a fairly focused view of the world. And you start falling victim to homophily. You start falling victim to what happens when your news and opinions are all coming from people who've got the same background and the same values that you do.
Remind me, homophily.
Homophily is the tendency of birds of a feather to flock together. It's the tendency of people to walk in a room and find the person who's most similar in background to you and to form a bond with them. And it's a very natural human tendency. Social scientists have done experiments 8 ways from Sunday, and you can see this all over the place. You can, you know, think about walking into a dining hall in college, and you'll see that people often group themselves frequently by socioeconomic class and by race. Even at extremely progressive schools, you seem to... It's a very basic human trait. But it's probably worth fighting. So Cass Sunstein, who's... actually, he's now coming to Harvard, which we're really psyched about. Amazing legal scholar, sort of dabbles as an internet scholar. And he sort of warns people that one of the real dangers of the internet is that we end up in circumstances where we're only hearing like voices. And his strong feeling is that if you end up in situations like this, you actually end up more polarized. If I only talk to other Obama supporters, I end up thinking that Hillary is, as my friend Samantha Power termed her the other day, a monster. Whereas if you talk with the Hillary supporters or you talk with the McCain supporters, maybe you get a more nuanced view over time. Homophily makes you stupid. It can make you really, really dumb. And what's incredible about the net is we have this opportunity to hear more voices and more different voices than really at any other moment in history. The potential to hear the Nigerians, the potential to hear the Burmese is greater than it ever has been. But the tools that we tend to build to it actually tend to have us listening to a lot of the same voices again and again. As we start looking at these tools that we've built over 15 years, what do they do well, what don't they do well, and how do we rewire them to work better for us? And I think that's one of the biggest questions that people building these tools are going to have to ask and answer.
Rewire just one of the tools, for example.
I think it would be very, very interesting if you search on Google for a breaking news story. If you get not only Google says, hey, I've got this topic in the news, but now I've got this topic in blogs. I think it would be very, very interesting when you search and look in some detail at a place or a country if you find information written from people from that place. I'm not necessarily a huge Jason Calcanis fan, but I'm fascinated by his project Mahalo, which tries to give you the perfect page of search results for a particular topic. I really hope that as he does that, he's looking not just for static pages, but he's looking for people, right? As you know from your work, Chris, in many cases, you know, the answer to the question, African economics, you know, you would respond to that and say, Jeff Sachs, you know, William Easterly, Paul Collier, and sort of go through the people on that. Search in the future needs to lead us towards people. It needs to lead us towards voices. It needs to lead us towards different places. And so my hope in all of this is that somehow we get over homophily. We start looking for really productive serendipity. The sort of serendipity when you go to that shelf in the library and you think you know the book that you're looking for, but you actually find the one you're really looking for within sort of 2 or 3 shelves from it. you think you're looking for information on the U.S. elections, and what you end up finding is how the Jamaicans are viewing the U.S. elections. You think you're looking for information about network security, and you find yourself learning about why Pakistan is so afraid of YouTube and how those things are going on.
Solana Larson.
Hi, Chris.
The voice of Global Voices. How does it work? What is first the theory and then the practice?
Well, I guess you'd say the theory is to try and kickstart some of this global communication that Ethan is speaking about occurring. You know, it's the World Wide Web as one would wish it would work, where bloggers from all over the world exchange information about what's going on in their own, on their own turf, in their own blogospheres from all over. So what we have essentially is a network of more than 100 bloggers who each report with varying frequencies on what's happening in their blogospheres. So we have regional editors who command a team of volunteers who each tell us and translate and say, well, this is what's happening in the Iraqi blogs this week, or this is what's happened in the Chinese blogs over the past months. These are some of the issues that you may not have read about in the mainstream media, but which are important to us locally, and
with,
which
with links to many more than 100
bloggers. The idea is for, in the first instance, it was to introduce an English-speaking audience to what's going on in all these different languages and regions that they may not be familiar with. What are, you know, Nigerian bloggers talking about? Here, link, go read, see, meet these people. I mean, just like Ethan said, we email, correspond on a daily basis, we work together, but we've only met once. I mean, the only reason I feel that I know Ethan, apart from working with him, is because I read his blog. And this sort of interaction you can build up with a lot of different people. And through reading the voices, original voices of ordinary people on different interesting issues, you get closer to them. You get closer to a sense of understanding of why people do what they do and how they feel. But how are you supposed to, just out of curiosity, I mean, even if you really wanted to know what Caribbean bloggers were saying about the United States elections, how would you know where to find the right one? How would you, in all the different blogs that exist in China, how would you be able to, you know, pinpoint the one that had right, that crucial bit of information? And that's where Global Voices has added a human element to it, which is unusual in most web 2.0 type projects, where you try and automate the sorting of the material that's generated on the web. We say, all right, we've got all these people reading who know their languages, who know their regions. Let's have them tell us what's worthwhile reading. And it doesn't matter if a blogger is famous, or they happen to be a housewife, or they happen to be, you know, a teenager who's writing something. They're posts are selected and highlighted on the merit of what they happen to be writing that particular day with regard to a particular issue. So every single day on the website, we have new articles from all over the world that tell us what's happening.
Can I ask arbitrarily, without pre-rehearsal here, Kenya. Everybody wants to decipher that situation. How would you do it on Global Voices?
Well, we have a team of Kenyans, Kenyan bloggers, who read the Kenyan blogosphere. I mean, Kenya is an especially interesting example, actually, because of all the post-election violence. And, you know, in the immediate emergency after the elections, the local media were shut down. No live reporting was allowed. So where did you go to get information? Who was taking pictures? Who was bringing their cell phones out to where the violence was happening? It was bloggers. So by collecting the different voices of bloggers, we upped our coverage. We provided round-the-clock updates on blogs, and we produced a feed that was, again, handpicked of different Kenyan blogs. We supported and linked to and highlighted some of the contributions that people were making, online activists within the country, to amplify the voices of different people. And we work together with mainstream media to connect them to bloggers that they could talk to give them email addresses and phone numbers to people who could give them the perspective that they needed from actual Kenyans.
How much variety, how complete a spectrum of Kenyan feeling, as well as, you know, politics itself do you think you get?
Well, I think Global Voices tends to highlight some of the more positive things that are happening. I mean, just like Ethan explained that bad things happen online, we know that. There's pedophilia, there's scamming, there's awful things. But there's a lot of hope and good work that deserves to be highlighted, perhaps more than you would get in traditional mainstream media. So we try and highlight some of these efforts. We've also covered discussion forums that used to be positive places that have been marred by really negative and racist discussions. So we try and balance it out. We try and link to different types of voices. We're not trying to be... we're not trying to say we know what people are thinking all over the world. Mm. The entire point is to show that there is diversity of opinion and that we see things differently, not just between countries, but also within countries themselves.
But just to be very fair about this, a lot of people come to Global Voices, I think, hoping for the voice of the man on the street.
Right.
And unfortunately, the man on the street isn't a blogger in most of the world. In the United States, you're still getting something of a bias. You're probably getting people who are better educated than the norm. You're getting people who have enough free time that they're able to blog. You're probably not working two or three jobs if you're blogging. And certainly once you get into the situation of Kenya, you're dealing with people who are highly educated, have some disposable income, have some time. What you're really dealing with is you're dealing with a middle class.
It may well have some education in America, too. Michigan State or...
In some cases, in some cases not. But at the very least, you're dealing with people who are often of sort of a slightly different educational stratum. Now,
right.
At the same time, these are real Kenyan voices. And these are voices
yes.
that you're frequently not going to get out of the New York Times, out of mainstream media. For the most part, when you're hearing from a Kenyan in a mainstream newspaper, you're either hearing from a national leader or you're hearing from the taxi driver. You're hearing from whoever the reporter who's parachuted into the country managed to get a comment from. In our case, you're getting commentary from people who are deeply engaged with these issues over long periods of time. And so what happened in Kenya was really very, very interesting. The read on Kenya from global media at first was, oh, here's another Rwanda, right? Everyone saw the violence in Eldoret and said, oh, we're going to see this nation go up like a torch. And the bloggers came back and said, no, you don't get it. This is political violence. This is not ethnic and racial violence. This was a thrown election. People are furious about that. But we also see evidence all over the place of people in communities looking for ways to make ethnic and racial peace. So what's interesting about this is you often get really different storylines coming out of this group of people than you might get out of mainstream media.
And I think it links back to what Ethan was saying before about, it's absurd in a way that you wouldn't get news about a place just because you didn't have a foreign correspondent there. I mean, and that's, I think, one of the mental shifts that's happening, where perhaps my generation, maybe some of the people here sitting in the room, would hopefully be the first ones to ask, well, that country is full of people. That country is full of journalists. That country is full of bloggers. There's absolutely no reason we shouldn't know what's going on in those places. We do not need a Western journalist, a mediator in this sense, in the way that we perhaps thought we used to. Things
well,
are
what is
changing.
The difference, did you think, in generalizing about the Western coverage? It was a British colony, after all, so Western media are familiar with Kenya. But if you had to generalize between what the British papers and professional journalists reported to the West, and the bloggers in the net told us, what's the difference?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily helpful to generalize in this case, because I don't think bloggers do anything as a whole. And if you look at the different blog communities that exist all over the world, you can't possibly predict what they will do and how they will say. The point is to look for voices, different voices, to look for local voices and to respect local opinion and the value of local opinion and to allow it to influence your point of view on what's playing out in a country.
I mean, one very concrete example in this, Chris, might be concerned Kenyan writers. And this is a group of young Kenyans, some of whom write fiction, some of whom write nonfiction, some of whom are bloggers, who found themselves coming together on online forums, found themselves starting Yahoo groups,
and put together a concerted campaign to get op-ed pieces out there. And the feeling was these writers wanted to contradict certain narratives. They wanted to contradict the narrative that all African violence is tribal. They wanted to contradict the narrative that Africa is always right on the edge of falling to pieces. They particularly wanted to contradict the narrative that Kenya was falling apart.
Mm.
At the same time, they wanted to talk about what had been a genuine electoral injustice. And so what's interesting about this is even, you're right, Kenya is probably the second best covered sub-Saharan African nation after South Africa. A lot of correspondents have been there. Any correspondent who's worked in Africa knows Kenya and has sources there. And yet the coverage that came out was pretty bad.
Mm.
And pretty straightforward, oh no, it's the descent into hell. And this may be the function of reporters who are parachuting back in. This may be the function of having now 50 years of post-independence narrative that people are trying to play into. But what's fascinating about the situation in Kenya is that Kenyans have pushed back telling their own stories. There's a website nowadays called Ushahidi. And this is a website where Kenyans started posting evidence of violence that took place because they wanted to make sure that they were tracking all the violent incidents. But they did something fascinating at the same time with the same system, which is an SMS-based system. You can report what the violence is going on in your community. You can also report on the peace efforts. And so they've been building a pair of maps, one which is covered with fires all over the western part of the country and one which is covered with doves, of groups of village elders getting together and meeting and looking for ways to keep the peace. When one of the Kenyan message boards, one of the online forums that was incredibly popular, got out of hand, its administrators took it down and pushed people towards a site titled I Have No Tribe, which invited people to write about a Kenyan identity independent of tribal identity. And you had Kenyans all over the world writing in and essentially saying, you know, we're beyond tribe in Kenya, or saying, hey, we're not beyond tribe. You know, I'm a Luo and I'm proud of it, but I want to make sure that this doesn't keep me, you know, apart from my Kikuyu brothers and sisters. Mm. These aren't narratives that came out real well in the mainstream press. They were all over what we've been doing in this. This is what we've been really focusing on in a big way. This, the tensions in Serbia and Kosovo, the near war in Latin America. It's been a busy spring for us so far.
Yeah, generalize, if you will. I want to push for the generalization on, say, Iraq, where the Bigfoot journalists of all the Western media, especially American, landed with the troops. But we also got in the wonderful habit of reading sites like Baghdad Burning and other Iraqi volunteers about the pain of this whole time. What did you learn in that process from Global Voices Online, but just in general, the development of a completely new way of seeing a war zone?
Well, I can't say I think that it's been all that positive a reporting experience. Reading the media, I mean, as Ethan says, Iraq is one of the stories that's red hot on the map of global media coverage, but you don't really hear from Iraqis very often. And certainly not when it's being discussed on television news debates here in the country or even in the press. How many op-eds do you read written by Iraqis that are actually based in Iraq? How many debates between Iraqis of differing points of view do you actually hear about? I mean, it's almost as though each side is trying to colonize the point of view of Iraqis. So the anti-war people will say, oh, Iraqis don't want war, and the pro-war people have always said that the Iraqis did want war and are happy for the invasion. So it's hard, and I think projects like, for instance, Alive in Baghdad, another video project where they've got Iraqi reporters who are doing weekly video reports from Baghdad, they are met with this difficult situation where people do refer to them as volunteers or citizen reporters. I've spoken to the head of the project, his name is Brian, and he says, well, it's really difficult because these are journalists, professional journalists who just happen to be Iraqis. And for some reason, as soon as they're being sourced or referenced by Western media and probably also Western readers to some extent, they become transformed to an inferior voice. Somehow they're less qualified to report on their own condition than a complete foreigner, a stranger. And I'm not saying that there isn't a space for journalism. I'm consider myself a journalist. I think that there's wonderful writing that comes from foreign correspondents and wonderful things that could come out of seeing a country from abroad. This isn't a heckle on that form of journalism as such, but I think it's important for journalists to diversify their sources. I think we need more respect for different voices, and Iraq is an excellent example of where it's needed.
We need to retrain ourselves too, I find, and I'm a journalist of the old school, and I go first to the New York Times, no matter how unsatisfying I find it. I think we've still got to train ourselves to listen to those other voices. What was the net impact on your head, Ethan, of the digital voices on coming from Iraq, about Iraq?
Well, first of all, let me say that, you know, despite running this vast web community that's giving so many other perspectives on it, one of the first things that I do is pick up the New York Times on it. This isn't designed in any way to be an alternative to old media. We're designed as the yin to the yang, right? I mean, the idea behind this is in reading that story in the Washington Post, in reading that story in the New York Times, in finding yourself going, okay, this is interesting, but I don't feel like I have a way into this. We're trying to give you sort of a human way to get into that story.
I hope you are developing an alternative to the New York Times.
But
why
it's
not?
Because it's extremely hard to do what journalists do well. It's extremely hard to hope that an average Iraqi civilian on the street, who frankly isn't on the street all that often, is able to go out and report on recent violence or is able to report on what's going on in parliament. You do need professional journalists to do that news gathering function. But we now have a much more complicated ecosystem where that opinion function, and particularly the agenda setting function, can now be the province of citizens as well as the province of professionals. But look, we are the last people to pull professionals out of the game. One of the things we get an enormous amount of flack for in the Web 2.0 community is the extent to which we're edited. We are a heavily, heavily editorially driven community. We choose what correspondents cover what countries. We end up choosing out of their work what goes on the front page and what gets featured and what doesn't. Our editors give a great deal of feedback sometimes to the correspondents. We're trying to take what's best about these traditional models of media and sort of marry them to these new models of media. Mm. Getting to your question about Iraq and what we got out of it, I think what we got out was a human face. As the U.S. prepared to invade Iraq, I know that I was one of 100,000, 200,000, 400,000 people reading Salem Pax and trying to get the perspective of what it felt like to know that your country was going to be invaded, to know that your army was going to be crushed, and to sort of wonder what was coming next from the voice of this sort of wonderfully articulate young architect who happens to be my age, listened to some of the same music that I listen to, and has traveled some of the same countries that I've traveled to. That was one of those moments where the fact that, you know, Salem Pax was not an average Iraqi. He was actually quite well-educated, quite Western. But he was a bridge figure. He was a bridge blogger. He was capable of explaining what was going on in the minds and hearts of Iraqis in a way that was very, very difficult to get out of American media at that point. And at best, that's what some of our correspondents are able to do. At best, they're able to give you the human side. Why did all those people go out into the streets to protest against the FARC in Colombia? What's it like to live in one of Latin America's better and better governed countries, but still have this insurgency, this drug-fueled insurgency that's been going on for 20 years? How frustrating is that as a university student to know that your nation is never going to make it beyond a certain point because essentially you're dealing with guerrilla warfare at all times? That human piece of it is what you can get out of citizen media.
Solana Larson.
There's something I'd add to that, because it's true, as Ethan says, that we are heavily edited. I mean, the whole human element, selecting all these things. But at the same time, there's a contradiction in the way that you'd normally be an editor, where you would tell a journalist to go write a story, and you'd expect that journalist to at the very least, bring home the same story that all the other journalists have brought to all their other publications. As editor of a website like Global Voices, I don't tell people what to write, ever. I wait for the stories to come up. It's a different bottoms-up thing, because I don't presume to know what is really happening in the Chinese blogosphere. And I can ask people to report more on Chinese Olympics or more on this or that, but it makes no sense, because the idea is to know what is important in this place. So that kind of openness in the editorial structure and having a less sort of centralized arrogance about what needs to be told is really important to the process as well.
I just want to remember that we're still talking about a huge transformation of models of journalism. I think of the old model as the John Burns Bigfoot, send your best guy into Ulaanbaatar, give them 10 days to figure it out, write it well, and tell the most influential audience in the world what the hell is going on. The new model is tune into maybe many thousands of people in Ulaanbaatar and let them tell the story themselves, sort out even among themselves who's the authoritative or who's the most comprehensive voices on the situation, and hear from them daily. People with on the ground with experience, passion, commitment, investment, and do it as a regular thing. These are the early days, and they're bent by, as you say, these writers that we're talking about are not absolutely typical. They're geekish. They're westernized already. But it's a start. What's the next step, do you think, in this transformation?
Well, so I think...
The one that the students in this classroom are going to be engaged in over the next 10, 20 years.
I think the next step, Chris, is setting the agenda. And I think that model, that parachute model of jumping into Ulaanbaatar, finding out that all anyone is talking about is sumo, because, of course, that's all that people talk about in Ulaanbaatar nowadays, now that the Mongolians are dominating world sumo and have both yokozunas. But putting that aside for the moment, what's really interesting is when citizen media gets to set the agenda and sets the agenda for mainstream media. If you are a New York Times reporter and you're looking for stories in China, you are probably looking for economic stories. How is the U.S. slowdown affecting the Chinese economy? You're always looking for democracy and repression stories because there's an endless appetite for it. And you're probably looking for Olympic stories. Will they be ready? What will we see from it? How is that going to change things? The story you probably would have missed, unless you were reading the blogs, was about ant farming. And this is a story that did not get a ton of attention in the U.S., but should have. It's very difficult to invest in China nowadays. If you're an average Chinese citizen, the interest you get from your bank isn't worth very much. It's difficult to buy shares on the open market. And so what you have is basically the Albanian economy immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall. You have people investing in Ponzi schemes and pyramid schemes. And one of the most popular ones has been ant farming. Companies come to you, they give you a cardboard box filled with ants. You pay $100, $200, $500 for this ant farm, and the company agrees that they will buy ants from you as they grow up. And before you conclude this is completely insane, you should mention that ants are used in a great deal of Chinese traditional medicine. There are these companies that look like very formal, well-run establishments that claim that they're going to make herbal Viagra out of ants. And what ended up happening is in Shenyang, which is a Rust Belt village, people were defrauded out of literally over $100 million through these ant farm scams.
Not even Nigerians.
These are Chinese ant farmers defrauding other Chinese who, in many cases, lost their life savings on this. And what was interesting for us, we started covering the story not because we somehow had knowledge that Chinese economics was something that we wanted to follow, but because the blogosphere exploded. And what happened was lots of Chinese bloggers knew a friend or a family member who had lost money in ant farming and who wanted to tell the story. The Chinese government predictably reacted by shutting down a lot of these sites. In many cases, we had the only copies of the videos or the documents of people talking about the ant farm scams. We got blocked for the first time in China. We've been reporting on China for 2.5 years. We even reported on when China arrested and detained our China editor. And we started a human rights campaign to get him released. That didn't get us blocked by the Chinese government. But ant farms was a different story, because people were taking to the streets in Shenyang to protest losing their money from ant farms. At the end of all of this, the Chinese government stepped in and offered to compensate people for the money lost. And they executed the guy who was running the scheme. Now, this may not be the sort of consumer protection function we want to have all the time, but it is a really interesting function as far as being able to tell you what stories to watch. What we learned out of all of this is that what's really interesting in China right now isn't necessarily the human rights stuff, isn't necessarily the Olympics stuff, it's the economics. The economics is what puts people out into the street. We would not have known that had we not been listening to Chinese citizens writing in Chinese and letting that filter up from the blogs and set our news agenda.
Which is why it's not just an economic story, but also culture, also politics, also media, and so many different things that play in. It's also youth and old people. And this was our most read story on Global Voices in 2007.
Wow.
And, I mean, the amount of people from China and from all over the world who came to the story was really, I mean, it was really a good reminder that the stories that we centrally, editorially, I mean, I happen to be based in New York, the stories that I think are going to be the big ones are never the ones that make the biggest splash on Global Voices. Ant farmers was big. Tropical storms all over the Caribbean were big. We can't predict it. That's the whole crux.
Well, that's a sign of victory if your apple cart is turned over and over and over. So, Lana Larson, I just want to ask before, I want to throw it to the students, but you came to Global Voices from another of my favorite sites, Open Democracy, which is a very different kettle of fish. It's opinion, it's London-based kind of commentary on a whole variety of subjects all over the world. What's the thread here? What's the secret of Open Democracy? Why do I love it so much?
Well, I was an editor with Open Democracy for about 5 years, almost right since it began. And I think it's a very different website in that it has very professional-type qualified voices, people who've written books, people who have been in positions of power in their field. But I think what's hardwired into Open Democracy in the same way as Global Voices is this respect for different points of view from different parts of the world. So while it is a London-based website, we've always, at Open Democracy, been extremely good at commissioning, you know, in the old-fashioned sense, commissioning as editors, voices from people who had firsthand knowledge of events around the world. So, I mean, to use the Iraq example, we didn't source Iraqi bloggers at the time, but when people were talking about whether or not to invade Iraq, we were the only publication that I can think of that organized a debate between Iraqi academics about what should happen. And these are written, you know, essay-type debates where we had back and forth, and we showed that, you know, that things aren't black and white. And so Open Democracy has tried to create a space on the web for this type of really high-level, open debate about different global political issues.
Yeah. Thank you. Kids, this is the future. This is what we can see from here. It's your turn.
You were talking about traditional media and this new media being yin to yang rather than one replacing the other. Do you foresee some sort of convergence, or is this, should there be somehow two forms?
I think convergence is harder than it looks. Every mainstream media company out there that isn't actively burying its head in the sand is trying to figure out how to diversify a little bit. And so you're seeing mainstream newspapers figuring out ways to do comments and hiring bloggers and so on and so forth. And a lot of the time it doesn't work very well. I every Sunday involves Week in Review from the New York Times, and the one feature that I now consistently skip is their reader feedback, because it's essentially like reading blog comments on a week-old blog where you didn't read the post in the first place. It's such a phenomenally inept way of doing things. And they're trying very hard, and I sort of want to pat them on the back, and they've been good about using our content, and they're doing well in a lot of places, but it's just a very, very different mentality. I think a lot of journalists are still very defensive about this. I have a lot more hope for sort of new journalism models that are trying to figure out how to take the best of both sides of the equation. I think of, you know, things like Salon or the Huffington Post or these sites that explicitly see themselves as online entities are participating in the same sort of money-making, market-driven space that mainstream journalism is, but are also leaning very heavily on the sort of community dynamics. The downside of these sites, by the way, is that there's some things they're really, really good at and some that they're not very good at. Most of these sites tend to be very good at giving you chocolate cake and not very good at giving you broccoli. They're good at giving you political horse races. They're really good at giving you celebrity gossip. And they're not so good at helping you figure out what the U.S. Marines are doing in Somalia. And I think one of those real questions is going to be how you do that sort of very difficult, very complicated international news in this new hybrid model.
Do you ever worry about, I mean, because I'm guessing the people who are reading your blog are all sort of, not all, but a lot of them are sort of like us, like sort of like globally minded, maybe educated to a certain extent. Like, do you ever worry about, like, who's accessing, like, whether or not it's, like, available enough? Or, like, even reading about, like, the ant farmers, because we were sort of asked to read this beforehand, I was reading it, and I didn't really understand, and I probably should have Wikipedia'd it, like, ant farming, like, why ant farming, what exactly happened, and, like, sort of the nuts and bolts of the story before you can get to, like, really the impact of it. And do you worry about that at all, or is that something you're working on?
Well, there's two levels to your question. One is who's reading, and the other is how do you make these local stories easier to understand? And I asked you guys to take a look at the ant farmer post in particular because it's so strange to outsiders why ant farming would be interesting. But if you look down, I mean, the issue isn't the ants or the medicine, or it's the protest, the people story, the emotions, which we all understand. Your sister's been defrauded of everything. And writing that experience down is something which is, I mean, universally understandable. I think what we try and get our authors and editors to do with, you know, with varying degrees of success is to try and explain it in a local context. So I think many of our writers are, as you say, global citizens, people who have traveled in many different places, who speak several different languages, who are able to explain this so that it makes sense. As for our readers, I'm not so sure that that's always the case with them. Our second biggest readership group in 2007 was in China. We have people coming from all over the world reading the site, and we have a community of volunteers that have sprung up around the English language content on Global Voices and volunteered to translate it into a dozen different languages. So Global Voices posts, selected Global Voices posts, are now translated into Bangla, Hindu, Arabic, Spanish, French, Portuguese, Japanese, Chinese. And this is volunteers who participate in this project in order not just to tell an English reading audience what's happening, but also to transfer back so that the Chinese bloggers can read what people are writing about them, so that there could be an opportunity for back and forth. And it's still, in a way, patchwork solution. You know, we don't all speak the same language and we're not all the same place, but we're trying to make some inroads.
I had a meeting this morning with the CEO of Huffington Post. And one of the first things I mentioned when she asked me for impressions on her site was that she really had almost no content in Malagasy. And, you know, we now have a ton of our content translated into Malagasy. And why one would choose to go after Madagascar as an audience, well, we didn't choose. We chose because we had a set of translators who were really interested and wanted to get into it. To a certain extent, you're right when you say this must be a very savvy, globalized audience. Yes, and 80% are not in the U.S. One of the things that's been fascinating with this site is discovering how much of our reader base is overseas. Another thing that's been fascinating is trying to figure out why people are reading this. And what's happened is, in many cases, we are a resource for three different communities. We're a resource for academics who take these countries seriously and study them on an ongoing basis. We're a resource for journalists who are writing about these countries and looking for story ideas and looking for sources. And somewhat embarrassingly, we're a source for the intelligence community. When we look through our logs, we see a lot of accesses from the U.S. and various different European intelligence agencies. And to a certain extent, I think they're looking at us as a way of monitoring chatter, which is sort of fascinating. I mean, to me, that implies that we're doing something right. This, to be very clear, is not our target audience. But it is sort of fascinating to discover that we're creating a resource that could be useful for such disparate groups.
What about local gossip just in Madagascar? I mean, people in Madagascar who want to find out, you know, who's doing what to whom, or who's thinking about this issue or that.
Well, for people in Madagascar, there is always the Malagasy blogosphere. I mean, they can already read their own blogs. The idea is to cross borders. So
I think it is happening in Madagascar, Chris. I just think the real question is, the question you should be asking there is, what's hot on the street in Madagascar?
Exactly.
And ideally, we should be able to get that by going to Global Voices and looking through our Malagasy coverage and being able to answer that question for you. But part of this, I think, gets back to the ant farm question, which is, it's not easy for us to give you that answer to that question. There's really three things we have to do. We have to follow those blogs very carefully and tell you what's important within it. We have to translate, because my guess is that your Malagasy is pretty weak. And then we have to add some context around it so that you can actually understand what's going on. When you see a blog post, the blog post isn't going to bother telling you ant farming is about this and this, and this is what we all think about this business. It's simply going to jump in and saying, here is the protest around Yilishan, and it's our job to give you the context. And if we don't have it right, then we sort of failed as editors on that. And that was a breaking story.
Global Voices has started this other project, Voices Without Votes, which is to say perspectives on the American election among people who will be inescapably affected by the American choice. What are you learning?
Well, it's interesting because Global Voices, when it was created or you know, by popular vote among our volunteers, decided we cover the whole world, but except the United States and Western Europe. There's enough going on in terms of covering and making sense of what's happening in the U.S. So we don't have a U.S. editor in the same way that we have a Central Asia editor. But people are talking about this issue. People are talking about the United States, and they're talking about the foreign policy decisions made in the U.S. and how it affects their everyday life and condition. So we were approached by Reuters to try and figure out, well, what are world bloggers saying about the election? Are there any stories there? Is there anything we could learn from it? And we've used many of our same volunteers. Our Middle East editor is managing the project. And we've created a whole separate website called Voices Without Votes, which is going to be running until the end of the U.S. presidential elections, that every single day aggregates posts from blogs all over the world, anywhere that isn't the United States, to try and synthesize, aggregate, give different perspectives on how this is actually a decision. The decision who to vote for actually is a decision that affects the rest of the world.
You're living out that wonderful joke about the guy who says, enough about me, let's talk about you. What do you think of me?
And I'll tell you, Chris, I really hated the idea of this project. And I actually turned down the first five or six groups that came to us. And people would say, I really think Global Voices should do coverage of the election. And I would say, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I'd start talking about the Ghanaian elections, which is a really nice way to throw American newspaper editors off their stride, because they're generally not too up on that election, which takes place only a couple of weeks after the U.S. election. Mm-hmm. But Solana talked me into it, and she was absolutely right.
I think it's a great idea.
I was absolutely right. And
you're American.
We've been amazed by... you know, just what these perspectives are. And, you know, Haitians really upset about, you know, Hillary's attacks on Obama. And, you know, interesting perspectives that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise out of the Kenyan blogosphere about how different ethnic groups seem to be siding on this. Israel has been fascinating in all of this. Israel is deeply, deeply, deeply worried about a democratic administration and what that might mean for U.S. foreign policy. Towards that country. So it's been fascinating, but, you know, it certainly had us worried at the beginning of it.
I had a question more about, just looking at the site, I've yet to see an advertisement, and I'm really curious about the business model for Global Voices and for other sort of news blogs, because if it doesn't have a print counterpart, how does it support itself?
So are we. we're really curious, too. One of the reasons we haven't put up ads is that at this point we don't know whether it would generate relevant enough amounts of revenue. Global Voices is very well known in the blogosphere. It's probably ranked about 80th, maybe 85th in terms of all the blogs in the world. But when you put it up against a mainstream newspaper in terms of traffic and visits per month, you know, we get in the neighborhood of 350,000 unique visitors a month. As compared to media sites, which might be getting 5, 10, 20 million. Conventional wisdom sort of says that ads don't really make money until you're up to about a million a month. And so at this point, we have largely focused on diversifying the contributor base, building up the editorial team, and we've largely been supported by the foundation community. Now, on the one hand, that sounds like a cop-out. On the other hand, it's worth noting that serious journalism, particularly serious international journalism, is also increasingly being funded by the foundation community. It's the most expensive sort of journalism to do. It's the riskiest. And in many cases, it's the broccoli. It's not the chocolate cake. So if you're going to spend the money to send a reporter to Somalia and the incredible insurance payments that you would have to pay, as well as the armed guards, as well as, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you're going to get a story that most of your readers aren't all that interested in, the only way you're going to get that story increasingly is when foundations, when people who are really interested in those parts of the world stand up and say, it's important that we get that sort of coverage. We have built this so far as a nonprofit organization, an NGO, without a lot of focus on revenue. We're realizing that we probably need to get smarter about a balanced model. And one of the things that we're thinking about nowadays is how do we take advantage of the fact that we've got the Economist's audience? You know, our readers are some of the smartest people in the world. They're some of the most influential people in the world. We have a smaller audience than USA Today, but we also have an audience that you can target quite a bit more than you could target sort of a publication like that. So it's one of the things we have to start about. But once again, I would sort of come back to the language we used at the beginning of this. This isn't a business. This isn't an organization. This is a conspiracy. And, you know, most conspiracies have pretty poor revenue models, and I think we share that characteristic at the moment.
Could I ask you both in wrap-up? There's so much daylight out there, so much reason to expect better information. Who's going to be better informed 10 years from now, and how? How will those of us who really want a more nuanced, more sophisticated view, not just of them, but of how they see us, a view of ourselves, too. How will we get there? And which among us will?
I think it'll be those of us who ask the questions. I think a lot of people come to us and ask us to come speak and say Global Voices is fantastic and applaud us for what we're doing. But the truth is that we rely on people to actually read us. I mean, and not just because of potential advertising revenue, but because the thing that keeps people blogging and talking is the idea that somebody's listening. So if you really care about this and you'd want that kind of a future where people were listening to each other and cared about the impact that they had on each other's lives, you have to start by asking the questions. And that means in search engines, in blogs, it means engaging. That's what I think personally.
If I were to bet on who's going to be best informed 10 years from now, I'd probably put my money down on my friends in cyber cafes in West Africa. If you are willing to spend 20% of your daily income to go in and spend an hour and a half in front of a computer terminal scanning headlines from around the world while CNN plays on one TV in the background and Al Jazeera plays on another one, you end up with a pretty powerful global view. One of the real problems in America right now is that we are drowning in a sea of information. And so we don't realize what an amazing opportunity, what an amazing resource this is. We have the potential to get more diverse, important, fascinating points of view than at any other moment in time. And we're remarkably bad about doing it. And so I think to a certain point, you know, when you're lazy about this, you end up missing out. It doesn't surprise me that such a huge percent of our audience is international. I really think that by virtue of thinking that we're in the dominant culture of the world, we are in many cases missing out on the perspectives that we get from looking from the outside in. And I hope we'll find a way
well
to reverse
said.
It, but I'm not optimistic.
Well said. We have to use our own machines, in other words, to get as smart as we're making West Africa.
It's a challenge for every one of us as a news consumer.
Ethan Zuckerman, Solana Larson, thank you so much. You're pioneers, and it's a thrill to have you at Brown and to be listening to you on Open Source. Thank you.